One thing about me is that I'm mortal, like I'm an organism, which is weird on its own. Like I'm a collection of literal atoms that decided to hang out together for a while and which will eventually be unable to hang out together any longer. And then I will, this is the weirdest part, cease to be. And there's nothing that can be done about that because, like, planets and stars also cease to be. It's a real conundrum, and I'm not going to find my way through it in this advertisement. But we can make life less terrible for those who survive us, and that's why there's life insurance. I have life insurance because the people who are counting on me will be supported after my atoms can no longer hold it together, and Policy Genius is here to make life insurance easier. Policy Genius isn't an insurance company, it's a marketplace where buying insurance is straightforward and affordable. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams, so check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as we're calling it this week, Dear John and Sarah.
It's a podcast where two brothers, or in this case, two married people, give you advice, answer your questions, and provide you with all the week's news from both AFC Wimbledon and, let's be realistic, probably not Mars. I am joined by my lovely spouse, Sarah Urist Green. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, John.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm tired, and I feel like I'm getting a lot of flack for being tired over the last 24 hours. We have a significant amount of jet lag, and I am the only person in the family who is feeling it, but it is still real.
You are quite dramatic about it.
I am really tired.
Well, I told you that I have a relationship change with jet lag. Ever since I became a mother and had to experience the many, many months of sleep deprivation that comes with being a new mother.
Oh, there's a lot of sleep deprivation? You never mentioned that.
I was super whiny then, for good reason, yeah. I believe. But ever since then, jet lag is sort of, like, funny to me.
Because it's such a minor problem.
Well, and you adjust. It's real. It's just that it ends.
Right. You do adjust. I think the issue for me is that I had not meaningfully changed time zones in 2.5 years.
Okay.
And then I did.
All right.
And I think my 44-year-old body is having a difficult time with it. So listen, we just had a 30-hour travel adventure.
We did.
And it was not that fun.
I watched some new movies.
But we have a strict policy in our family of never complaining about bad travel experiences because the only thing more boring than other people's dreams is other people's travel problems.
That's right. And also, it was such a joy to travel that
it was.
It was worth it.
It was. That's a great point. There's a couple things I want to bring up before we answer some questions.
Okay.
First, and most importantly, Hank and I have not made an episode of Dear Hank and John together in I don't know how long, and it was occurring to me recently that it could be that we're, like, hiding a feud, that he and I are, like, having a huge argument.
Like you had a falling out.
Yes. And everything is collapsing, like a sort of brotherly divorce.
That doesn't seem very likely, though.
Well, but, like, that's, wouldn't this be how we would handle it? Like, oh, Hank's doing an episode with Roman Mars. I'm doing an episode with Sarah. Like, we're not collaborating. I missed the most recent now, Dear Hank and John Patreon live stream because of jet lag.
Now, did you think of this theory or did somebody else?
No, I just thought of it this morning. I was like, what if people are worried that Hank and I had a huge falling out?
Well, let's ease everyone's minds.
Yeah.
They're fine.
Yeah, we're just busy.
Just like any people in a relationship, sometimes they need some time apart.
Whoa. What? Is that becoming it? Everything? The whole tone of this thing just shifted big time.
I was seriously talking about other people, not us. Because, you know, that's what this podcast is about, other people's problems.
Right. That's true. I'm just saying that Hank and I are getting along great. And as far as I knew, you and I were getting along great until 30 seconds
we
ago.
We are. All is well in the House of Green.
Sarah, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was I would like to propose that we do a podcast the way that Hank and Catherine have Delete This. And I have two concepts.
Okay. I thought we already had a hit podcast.
We do have
John.
A hit podcast. That's a great point. What's it called?
It's called Like Letters.
And what's it about?
Well, we only release it once a year.
That is the big problem with our hit podcast.
And it's a perk for donating to the Project for Awesome.
Yeah.
And it's when we read our early email correspondence to each other and laugh and cringe and talk about it.
That's right. Now, one of my proposals is, in fact, to make Like Letters a more regular podcast. So that instead of coming out once a year, it perhaps comes out once a quarter.
What's your other idea?
You don't like that one?
I'll consider it.
My other idea is we make a podcast about visual art that you can't see as the podcast listener.
Right. Well, that's the nature of the game, except you could go look at it online.
Right. You could. But I kind of like the idea of talking about a work of art without being able to see it. Like, it's just a different kind of engagement.
Right. Right. Or like we could describe it.
Yeah. Or try to describe it.
Right.
Like, you want to try it?
Right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's the best work of art you've seen in person recently? That's not in our house. Those don't count. I mean, I'm looking at a really good painting right now, but it's in the house.
Okay. I saw this amazing installation by Xu Bing.
Yeah. Trash in the back.
Trash in the back.
It had trash in the back.
Trash in the back. Beautiful landscape in the front.
Yeah.
And it was basically a giant light box.
Yeah.
That from the beginning of the room, you walk in and you see what looks sort of like a traditional Chinese landscape painting. But then you realize it's a light box. And then you walk around back of it and you see that it's actually a bunch of trash.
Yeah. Like and, bubble wrap
but
and
also
plastic bags,
leaves
and, little ferns that have been placed right up against the light box to become some of the trees in the landscape painting.
Right. And it was just both beautiful and also thought-provoking. And I spent a long time with it. And I was just reminded of how much in-person art experience matters.
Yeah. Well, because when you walk up to it, you think you're looking at one very specific kind of work, right? Like a traditional landscape painting. And then you walk around the back of it and you're like, oh, wow, this is something completely different. This was made largely out of like trash and discarded items.
That's right. And I think like, especially now, art has to make an argument for its physical existence.
Right.
You know, like that is an experience that even in VR wouldn't be that good.
Right.
You know, you got to be able to sense light changes.
Yeah.
You got to be able to see depth.
Right.
And like feel what it's like to walk around the room and see something from different angles. Yes, I realize it's sort of VR, but it's just not the same.
It's not. It's very hard to make that token non-fungible.
Right.
Yeah. I also loved that work. That was one of the highlights of our entire vacation, actually, was getting to see that one piece of art and the just complete surprise of walking around the back of it and seeing that it was made out of like bubble wrap and discarded blue plastic bags from Walmart or whatever.
Yes. So bravo, Xu Bing.
Good work. That's our podcast. It's called...
We're going to call it, for the time being, Untitled.
But it has to be Untitled with those
untitled
brackets.
Untitled Podcast. I'm sure that exists.
Oh, you know what was the best work of art I saw recently?
What?
Sorry, we will get to questions from our listeners. The best work of art I saw recently wasn't a work of art. It was a wall label.
Okay.
And instead of saying what wall labels always say about artists in ancient Egypt or in Africa or in the Islamic world or whatever, it always says anonymous.
Or artist unknown.
And what this wall label said was artist once known.
Right.
To emphasize the fact that it was a kind of failure of the way that we imagined history.
Or record history.
Or recorded history.
Or a failure of the way such an object came to be part of its current collection.
Absolutely.
Perhaps it was stolen.
Right. Right. And so it would be inconvenient to know the artist's name because then there would be a set of obligations to that artist mm-hmm. that you don't have if you say it's just anonymous or unknown. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yes, that was lovely. How about we get to some other people's questions?
It's a good idea, but I want to go a little further into this art podcast. What are we going to call it?
Let me mull it over while we answer questions.
This first question comes from Liz, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, how are art eras named? Like, art that was made in recent times is usually referred to as contemporary or modern." Oh, Liz, you have just opened a whole can of worms.
Oh, well, let's complete the question.
Both of which just boil down to mean current. Wasn't all art and music contemporary when it was made? When will our current era stop being contemporary? And most importantly, in the distant future, what will historians call the era we're in now? Landscapes and leitmotifs, Liz.
This is a great question.
Great question.
And I think we can get into some terminology in a little more detail in a little bit. But I'd like to actually answer the question first.
Yeah.
Which is that, yes, all art was once contemporary. All art was once new. And not all movements have been named while they exist. A lot of history, I mean, and not just art history, but history happens in retrospect. You know, we don't notice trends. We don't realize an era until it's over or perhaps long over. And, you know, when you study art history and you think about so-called contemporary art, which for museums is often like 1960s to today. But not always. Sometimes it's newer, you know, because the 1960s have kind of solidified somewhat into
pop
types
art and different minimalism.
Right. But so, you know, contemporary art I generally think of as art being made like in the recent past, and you define recent. But since the 1960s, there hasn't been very clear movements. And some movements are movements because a group of artists came together and was like, we are Dada. We
right.
are Dadaists, and we are a finite group. But that doesn't really happen now. You don't really see artists getting together and being like, we are going to do this one thing, and we are all going to go in this one direction. So it's not...
Sometimes you see artists all going in one direction, like Harry and Zane.
I knew that was coming. I knew.
But they couldn't do it forever, Sarah.
Right.
That's a great point. You know, eventually...
So it's history that decides.
They
it's
had to
you,
go in five directions.
It's actually you as part of that
right.
history making, because if you go out and see a bunch of art and you write a tweet, or let's say, or make a TikTok that's like, hey, you know, I went to see all the art in New York City today and I've decided that this is the movement that is happening. This is the prevailing trend amongst all of this wild and crazy art that I saw. And then you name it. You know, like maybe it's the banana movement or whatever. And like, and if enough people get behind you and was like, this is the bananas movement, mm-hmm. then it might be recorded as such eventually. But,
right.
you know, it's different. Sometimes, like, it's like if you think back about a lot of the art that was popular, say, in the 1990s, a lot of it now we think of as being about identity politics,
mm-hmm.
okay? So, like, but that wasn't something that sort of happened all of a sudden.
Right.
It was something that began to happen and began to be noticed, and then, like, later, bang, that's what the 90s was.
Yeah, this is very similar to the way that we talk about eras in history or the way that we talk about generations,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, how do generations get names and get defined is actually really often quite complicated, and it involves a lot of guesswork, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I always thought that Hank was Gen X, but it turns out he's elder millennial. Not because Hank changed, but because sort of our understanding of generations changed.
I actually think Hank, I am like, Hank is just, we're about the same age.
Yeah, you're like six months apart.
We're like 6 months apart, but.
But.
But I think I'm Gen X.
Yeah.
I'm like baby Gen X.
Yeah.
And he's elder millennial.
Yeah, but that's
I'm
mostly
on the cusp.
I would argue that's mostly because of your vibes. Like, I would argue that if Hank had your personality, he would be elder Gen X. I mean, baby Gen X. And if you had Hank's personality, you would be elder millennial.
Not to be insulted here.
It's good. I'm super glad I didn't marry a millennial. Aren't you? Yeah. Nothing against all the millennial listeners out there. You seem lovely.
Yeah, so I think Liz...
Jeez, John, way to alienate 80% of your
job,
audience.
Good job. So Liz, the only other thing that I will add is that the term modern when it comes to art, like you are definitely using it correctly, because anything modern, as we know, is sort of fresh and new. Mm-hmm. When you say modern art, that actually refers to a specific span of time. That aligns with like the modernization of cities, industrialization, the Industrial Revolution, like from 1850 to mm-hmm. 1950. Okay. Like that's a long span of time.
Yeah.
But as cities changed, as like culture moved from being more rural to urban, more artists were gathering in cities, art changed a lot while cities changed a lot. And so, like, in general, we went from, say, like, more academic, realistic style painting to crazy art, more abstract art, yeah. Trying new materials. So, like, that, there is an era called modernism
right.
in art, and different countries, different parts of the world had different modernisms, had sure. like modern art in different places. But when modern art is used, that's what it means. Something you didn't want to know. Sorry.
But that is really, I think that's really important, because a lot of people say modern art is a way of saying contemporary art, and there is a distinction.
Or abstract art.
Right. And there is a distinction. Modernism was not just an artistic phenomenon. It was a really broad
right.
historical phenomenon. I mean, the example of it that I always use is that in 1800, globally, over 95% of people lived on farms. And in 1950, globally, fewer than 50% did.
Mm-hmm.
And that shift was really dramatic, because the Industrial Revolution radically reshaped the human story.
Like, right. So, of course, it changed art.
Yeah. Like the Columbian Exchange did before it, like the Agricultural Revolution, which wasn't really like an event, but that also changed things. And so these big seismic shifts in the way humans organize themselves are always reflected in our artistic traditions.
Mm-hmm. And also, when you say modern art, we all know what you mean. So
yeah.
even if you're not referring to like that time period of art, most people know anyway.
You know, my favorite historical example of this, Sarah,
what?
The way that I think about it is that in 1914, we thought that we were in a period called the Great War.
Right.
And then later we realized that we were in a period called World War I. And right now, a lot of people are talking about World War III, which I think is very presumptuous. First off, I hope we can avoid any kind of World War III. But secondly, I'm not entirely confident that if there is some kind of like globally involved conflict, that it will be called or known as World War III. We don't know.
Right.
We don't get to name that stuff.
Somebody does.
Yeah, but it gets named, almost always gets named after us, because as Stan Muller likes to say, when you're living in the middle of history, you simply do not know what it means.
Right. There you go, Liz.
All right. We have another question, Sarah. This one's from Griffin, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I'm a creative writing student and I was recently published in the local library's literary arts scene. It's a lovely project that they've put together, but I can't help but feel that I either don't deserve it or that it's such a small accomplishment that I shouldn't even care about it. How should I feel about this? Obviously, I shouldn't feel like it's meaningless. Otherwise, why did I submit the piece in the first place? But I can't help but feel that it's stupid. I haven't told anyone except for a few other students because I don't know how to feel. Ashamed of sharing my work, perhaps? How do I get past this melancholy? Wish I had teenage angst to blame these feelings on. Griffin."
Oh, Griffin.
I remember this feeling. I mean, I still get this feeling to an extent, but I don't.
Yeah.
I read this question and I was like, I want to talk to Sarah about this because I don't know if you get this feeling, but can I describe it to you?
Sure. I mean, I think Griffin has, but let's hear another angle.
Here's my experience of it. Like, I remember the first time I was on NPR, like the like nationally.
Mm-hmm.
I'd written this like 1 minute, 40 second long commentary. And this was after years and years of writing for the Chicago-based NPR station.
Mm-hmm.
But only people in Chicago would hear that.
Mm-hmm.
This was a national thing. And it was a really, really big deal. Big deal to me. But I also had this feeling the first time I was published in Booklist, the first time I, you know, had experiences like Griffin's having here where mm-hmm. I published something, I would have this feeling where I would be really excited about it and really proud that it got included or that it got chosen or whatever. And then it would air or get published. And like within 15 seconds, I would feel this, what Griffin describes as a melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
I would feel like, oh, well, that was disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not very good. That's not a big deal.
Right.
That doesn't really change anything.
Right.
And I remember after that first NPR commentary, I just like sat in my chair in my basement and I was like, well, I mean, I made $40.
Well, I mean, so what I think is interesting here is like I'm feeling this impulse to minimize
yeah.
accomplishments,
yeah.
which I think is very natural. You know, like I think we may be internally proud of something, but when someone else brings it up, all of a sudden you hear it through their voice, and all of a sudden you feel stupid.
Right.
Or like it's really small. This definitely happens to me.
Yeah.
I think it can be hard to have someone else know about something. It's a vulnerability feeling
mm-hmm.
proud.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. It's like that Avett Brothers song, I want to have pride like my mama had and not like the kind in the Bible that turns you bad.
Right. Like how do you straddle that feeling of accomplishment mm-hmm. without making it pompous or being braggy?
But I don't know that impulse to minimize is about not wanting to be braggy. I think it's about like feeling really insecure
mm-hmm.
because it is a moment of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Like being proud of an accomplishment or being happy that you did something is a real moment of vulnerability because you know someone can come along at any moment and say it's not that big of a deal. People graduate from college all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of people get mm-hmm. published in your library's literary zine. Every accomplishment can be minimized like that. And so maybe it's that. Maybe it's that like self-protective feeling of like, well, I know that there are people who might easily undermine this or might easily point out that it wasn't that difficult. To me, the real judge of it is, was it difficult for you? And difficult,
but like, is it meaningful for you?
Is it meaningful for you? That's much better.
It doesn't have to be difficult, I don't think,
right.
for it to be meaningful.
Right. But what Griffin did was both difficult and meaningful. It's difficult to submit your work for publication.
Mm-hmm.
It's scary. There's not just a huge chance of rejection. There's the very likelihood of rejection. And also it was meaningful.
Right.
Something that they wrote that they care about. So like, to me, that is an inherently vulnerable thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this also reminds me of like, you and I over the years, like when we've had small accomplishments or large, we've tried to celebrate them.
Yes.
And it is easier to do it together, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So like, when John and I were earlier in our careers and like something seemingly little would happen, we would buy a bottle of champagne, you know,
yeah.
like our favorite $9.99 Freixenet Brut, you know, which I really recommend. This is not a plug.
No, it's not sponsored.
This is really good.
If Freixenet wanted to sponsor us, I want $0 and all the champagne.
Yeah.
I guess you can't call it champagne because it's definitely not from Champagne.
I think it's technically cava.
It's
but
so good.
It is very good.
We drink
anyway,
it at our wedding.
So, but
it's
we,
so good.
But actually, we got to a point where we were like, I think we're celebrating too many things.
Yeah.
Like especially as your star continued to rise. But we still think it's important to do. And like one thought I had while you were explaining your predicament, Griffin, is like, you know, maybe you can't now, but like with this zine, for example, like what if you had hosted a gathering for everyone who was in the zine,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
the library should have done that. But yeah.
Well,
but yeah,
or,
host
but,
a gathering.
But even if you said like you sent out a message to everybody,
yeah.
like I know this zine comes out every whatever. Let's gather to, you know, break bread, share a drink
yeah.
to celebrate it. And that way, like everybody's sort of on the same plane and
yeah.
you know, that might be fun.
I think that's a great idea. Finding ways to celebrate even accomplishments that might feel small to you is a really, for us anyway, like in our lives, we've experienced this, that's a way to get past that urge to minimize the accomplishment. That's exactly what I was going to say too, is like the reason that I felt this like really profound sadness after, you know, my first book came out, after the first NPR times, all that stuff, was because I was just alone
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't celebrating it. I was just kind of ruminating on how it wasn't that big of a deal.
Right. Well, I do think that there's a way to acknowledge or celebrate accomplishments on your own as well.
For sure.
I mean, like something that you and I have started to do in the past like 5 years is write sort of two letters to ourselves at the end of a year. For the first one is about kind of making a summary of things that happened in the year past, and then make another letter that's sort of about what you want for the year ahead. And for me, it's always a great thing to be like, you know, okay, maybe there were 5 or 6 small, quote unquote, stupid things that like on their own, I wanted to minimize. But when I looked at them together,
mm-hmm.
it's suddenly a life, you know,
it's
a career. It's something to be proud of.
I'm doing work and I'm
participating
in the world and taking care of a family. And
it's an additive process.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. So
Keep at it, Griffin.
Keep at it, and we hope you can find a way to celebrate this very real accomplishment, because it is real.
Yes.
This next question comes from Abby Sarah, who mm-hmm. writes, "Dear John and Hank, when I was in high school like 10 years ago," this is maybe the best question we've ever received.
Okay.
I have an issue like this, too. I think you might as well.
I'm excited.
"When I was in high school like 10 years ago, I had to come up with a sculpture theme for my art final, and I panicked, and I chose gnomes."
Yes. That's great.
"It became a running joke, and now my family and friends won't stop giving me gnomes. I think it's time to move on from this collection. What do I do with 50 gnomes, and how do I stop acquiring new gnomes? Do I just commit to the bit for the rest of my life? Where do I gnome from here, Abby?"
Abby, this is really just a wonderful question, and I thank you for putting it out into the universe.
Oh, it's like when you're like, say, 14, and you're an extremely toxic presence in your parents' lives. And one day, I'm not speaking from experience,
sure.
or anything, one day, your mom makes you spaghetti, and you're like, "Mom, this is really good spaghetti." And that's the only nice thing she's heard you say in like 18 months.
Yeah.
And so thereafter, she concludes that spaghetti is your favorite food, even though, as it happens, you don't actually like spaghetti. You were just in a good mood that day.
Right.
And you get fed spaghetti for like 30 years before finally you confess to your mother via a podcast that actually you've just never been that into spaghetti.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I think we all have this to a certain extent. And if you've ever started collecting anything,
yeah.
I think the people in your life who love you and or give you things are always excited to learn of a thing you like.
Oh, because it solves a huge
it's
problem.
It's like, oh, John loves pigs. I'm going to give
yes.
him everything pig themed I can find.
And
if you don't like it anymore.
Yeah, because it solves the problem for the gifter. That's what
right.
this is really about. The gnomes are not about you, Abby. They are about the people
and
giving you gnomes.
Because, you know, it brings them so much joy.
I know.
To
yes.
give you gnomes.
It
and
does.
I think...
And they're like, they see a gnome on vacation and they're like, this is perfect. You know,
right.
Abby
loves
gnomes.
And even I think at this point, they probably know that you're not excited about gnomes anymore.
Yeah.
And that it's something you feel a little bit of embarrassment about, which almost makes it better for them, especially
yes.
if it's
yes.
like a sibling kind
totally.
Of relationship.
Totally.
Because even if you declare that gnomes are over I don't think it's going to happen.
It may not
happen. I do think it's something you're going to have to live with for the rest of your life. But I think that it's something you can do something about.
So here's what I think. I almost always think you should be your authentic self, especially with the people you love.
But what if her authentic self is not wanting gnomes anymore?
Because sometimes you should not be your authentic self, Sarah.
Okay.
And one of those times is when you are in a period of your life where you don't love the gnomes. Stay with me here for a second.
Okay.
I think the gnome thing for Abby is going to be a sine wave. I think there are going to be periods like now where Abby is like, this is ridiculous. I never liked gnomes.
Mm-hmm.
I panicked once in high school and became a gnome person.
Yes.
But then I think there are also going to be periods where Abby's like, this is hilarious.
Yes.
I have one of the largest collections of gnomes in the world.
Right.
And I think that going through that cycle.
Sine wave
occasionally means can't fully be your authentic self. But you're not. The only reason you're not being your full authentic self, Abby, is because you know there will be another peak where you are like, just kidding. Mm-hmm. This is hilarious. I cannot believe that this happened to me.
Okay, I agree, but I'd like to add something to this.
Great.
Abby, I think you can make it more your own, this collection.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think you can think about a clever way to display it.
Mm-hmm.
Not just sort of on a shelf, but maybe you find some sort of glass container or plexiglass enclosure where you kind of stack them all in an interesting way. Inspired by Ai Weiwei, you could dip them all in the same colored paint, mm-hmm. and make it like you've sort of reclaimed the gnomes.
Yeah. Or inspired by Ai Weiwei, you could photograph yourself dropping the gnomes from a great height.
Yes, and smashing
and
the
then
gnomes.
Smashing the gnomes on the ground below you and just say to your family, listen, I love gnomes. I need them to keep coming because I'm making this art series.
Make videos of the gnome smashing. And then if they still give it to you, then you can smash some more.
Yeah. You can say, this doesn't mean I don't love gnomes. It just means that I've decided that energy being neither created nor destroyed, I've decided to change the form of the gnome.
The only other thing I could see is if you don't want to do something so dramatic, is if you can somehow state you're trying to find the world's smallest gnome. So at least it doesn't take up a lot of room. Or
I'm still really into gnomes, guys, but I like them to be less than 1 inch tall. That's my ideal. My ideal gnomes.
Who can find the tiniest gnome?
Is there a microscopic gnome?
Or you could try a replacement collection. You know, you could say graduated from.
Yeah, I'm not into gnomes anymore. I'm into snow globes now.
Oh yeah. Well,
I'm a snow globe person.
That's gonna present another problem. I was thinking of something very small. You know.
Oh yeah. I'm out of gnomes and I'm into E. coli.
I don't know. What's something tiny?
I was thinking
paper clips, but that's not fun. What could it be?
I think E. coli is a great solution. Just say to everybody, listen, I want one drop of the dirtiest water you can find when you're on vacation.
Yeah. So anyway, I think, Abby, this is really a wonderful.
What a great problem.
Quandary. I think you're going to be fine no matter what. But I do want to see what you might do with your collection to kind of retake it and feel some ownership over it.
Yeah. Yeah. But the main thing here, Abby, is that you have to keep collecting gnomes for the rest of your life. I'm not here to tell people how to live their lives, except in this one case.
Well, but it's sort of like, you know, you can only control the things you can control.
Yeah.
This is not something you can control.
That's true. All right.
The cat is out of the bag. The gnome is out of the bag.
Sarah, I've just been reminded that we need to mention our sponsors. Today's podcast is, of course, brought to you by Abby's Gnome Collection. Abby's Gnome Collection. It's growing. P.S. Abby, why didn't you include your address so I could send you a gnome?
Today's podcast is also brought to you by Freshenet. It's delicious. It's inexpensive, and it's perfect for celebrating all of your accomplishments, small and large.
Additionally, today's podcast is brought to you by Freshenet. I'm really trying to angle for a proper sponsorship here, Sarah. Freshenet.
Guess I didn't do good enough.
Huh? You did great. It's crisp. It wins the blind champagne tasting test that we do, like, say, every other New Year's Eve. It wins every year. It beats Dom Perignon. It is the best bubbly available.
Today's podcast is also brought to you by Modern Art. It's not just fresh and new. It's actually a finite span of time in which art was created.
Fresh and new is a really good idea for Freshenet's new bubbly, sparkling canned wine brought to you by Sarah and John.
Fresh
and
new.
We will sponsor you. Please sponsor us. We also have a Project for Awesome message. It's from Aunt Jean to Arthur Tighe and Allison Violet. Dear Arthur and Allison, you are just a little bit too young to start listening to this podcast, but I know in no time at all you'll be singing about anglerfish and quarks and counting down to the March launch, and then in a little bit longer you might cry and laugh with Hazel Grace and ask your parents when they're taking you to Amsterdam. Maybe even one day soon you'll cheer for AFC Wimbledon, though neither your moms nor I will know what to do with that since we are more like the athletes of the Quiz Bowl variety. I'm sorry that you were born in a world in which we let the 4.5-star Kauai O'o bird go extinct. I'm sorry you had to learn to walk and talk during such a decidedly one-star plague. I'm sorry our collective efforts to decrease world suck never seem to be enough. I do know that you two will be okay, though. Not just because of your inextinguishable capacity for wonder or because you'll be lucky enough to see the 5-star Halley's Comet cross across the sky in 2061, or even because of the existence of people like the scientists of the Vavilov Institute who protected the seed potatoes to save people they did not know. It's all that. But it's also that you both happen to have undeniably 5-star moms, and for that you are very lucky, and you'll never walk alone. Please hug your moms, Catherine and Nora, for me. I love them and you very, very much. Oh, that's so sweet.
This episode of Dear Hank and John is brought to you by Blue Land. The inside of your toilet is gross, and that's why you shouldn't let anyone in your household drink out of it, including your dogs, please. They let them close the thing, let them drink out of the bowl. The toilet is where the poop goes. There is an easy way to clean your toilet, though. Blue Land's sustainable toilet cleaner tablet. Just drop it in, watch it fizz, brush it up, and then flush. It's super easy, and the great thing about Blue Land is they are figuring out how to do all this stuff without any plastic at all. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and for the planet, and with the same powerful clean that you're used to. It uses no single-use plastics in any component, from bottles, tablets, to wrappers, and even to shipping. The tablet packaging, by the way, is fully compostable. Blue Land products are effective and affordable. The toilet tablets are proven to work on a range of toilet stains, including rust, mineral deposits, limescale, and hard water. And look, when it comes to me, I don't really care that much about bacteria in the toilet, because again, that's where the poop goes. That's where it's supposed to be dirty in there. But it is nice to have something to help you with those mineral deposits, which we have in abundance in Montana. You can get even more savings by buying refills in bulk or setting up a subscription. Their subscriptions are customizable and convenient, so you never run out of your most used products. We have been a Blue Land household for like 3 years now. It's super convenient, super good. Like it a lot. The products look nice. They're easy to use. And again, they do not require single-use plastics or shipping a bunch of water around, because it's like the stuff that's going to be in the water, you can just dissolve it in water yourself instead of having the companies ship water from place to place. Why are we doing this? Never do I think to myself, oh, this is less effective than other cleaning products. It's just not. It's effective, it's easy, and it's affordable. Blue Land has a special offer right now for our listeners. You can get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/dearhank. You don't want to miss out, everybody. blueland.com/dearhank for 15% off. That's blueland.com/dearhank to get 15% off.
So we all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but one thing you don't want to compromise on is your health. When it comes to your health, there should be no compromising. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on the latest headlines or their family group chat or the crossword puzzle just because they're available right now, or take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. You can search by location, available availability, and insurance. So literally no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. So go to ZocDoc.com/DearHank and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/DearHank. ZocDoc.com/DearHank.
So nice.
Gosh, we should really let the people who donate to the Project for Awesome write the entire podcast.
Answers, too?
Yeah, I mean, they're much better than we are. All right, Sarah, before we get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, I do have one last question for you.
Great.
It's from Darby, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, it's currently 5:03 in this college dorm room in Texas, and I've been listening to your podcast between biochemistry lectures, and I'm wondering something. I know y'all memorize a lot of quotes and song lyrics and keep lists to remember them, and I do as well, but I am particularly interested in Latin. Do you like to learn Latin phrases? One of my central mantras is inventas vitam luvit." I'm really good at pronouncing Latin.
You did
take Latin.
It's one of the things
I'm known for. I took Latin 1 three times. I took Latin 1 in 9th grade. I got a C-. Then I took Latin 1 in 10th grade. And then I took Latin 1 in college.
Okay, let's try. Give it your best shot, John.
Inventas vitam juvat exculius per artis, which translates to "let us improve life through science and art." I thought you would appreciate that. I find that both of you follow this notion beautifully. Glucogenesis is important for the brain, apparently, Darby. Good job studying for biochemistry, Darby.
I feel like Darby's going to be a little disappointed Hank's not answering this.
Will Darby be disappointed that Hank's not answering this? Or will Darby be thrilled because two people who fell in love partly through Latin phrases are answering
it? It's true. So when John and I first started becoming friends and exchanging emails, I had this great book of Latin quotes called Amoa Masamat and More.
Yeah.
And I really found it helpful for figuring out email sign-offs, you know? Because it sounds pretentious and a little silly now.
It doesn't sound pretentious. I think it's super cute.
But
it would be
sort
pretentious.
It gave you, John, the recipient, like a little something to look up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You could figure it out.
Yeah. I think it started because we were talking about how we both liked Rushmore.
Yes.
And there is a line in Rushmore where Max Fisher, the main character, like saves the Latin program at the school.
I saved Latin. What did you ever do? Sick but Transit also, Gloria.
Sick Transit Gloria. Glory fades. That's like that's the line that he uses to try to woo this teacher.
Yes.
And Sick Transit Gloria is such a great classic observation. There are so many, though. Like, I have so many favorite Latin phrases. I did a whole advertisement for Policy Genius just on the Latin phrases that were on sundials. Like, Memento Mori is the most famous one. Like, remember that you must die. But there's also ones that are like, it's later than you think.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Yep. Yep. And there's also the Ne Bastarde Corporatorum Esse, which is actually, my Latin is also poor.
Really good.
But it's Don't Let the Bastards Get You Down.
Yeah, that's a good one. Don't Let the Bastards Get, that's like new Latin, you know? Like,
oh yeah, it's not pure.
Yeah, but it's almost better.
There's also Ars Longa Vita Breva. Art is long, life is short.
Yeah, although I have an issue with that one.
You do?
Yeah, art is also short.
I know.
In the scheme of things.
But it can last longer than life.
Yeah, but this, like, the using art as a way of, like, grasping for immortality feels very...
It's a little empty.
Very passé. To me.
Yes.
It feels a little Picasso-y.
Yeah.
Something feels like late 19th, early 20th century.
Right.
That's the vibe
like
I get.
A little heroic.
Slightly patriarchal.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of natura non constristatur, which means nature is not saddened.
Mm.
Like when...
Nature don't care.
Yeah. Nature's good. Nature doesn't care much.
I think it does,
But that's another one that feels a little more 19th century than it feels now. Because I think
nature cares a heck of a lot.
Right now, nature is like, I do kind of wish you would make me less sad.
Yeah. And there's, of course, a more vincit omnia, love conquers all, which is a little cheesy, yes. Yeah. But I think what I like about it is the follow-up that comes after it, which is...
Et nos sedamus amori, and so we shall yield to love.
Right, which is the much lovelier part, I think.
It's so lovely that it's written on the inside of both of our rings.
Yes.
All right, Tara, it's time for the all-important news from AFC Wimbledon. As you'll remember, Sarah, AFC Wimbledon have not won a game in April, but they also did not win a game in March or in February. Oof. Or in January. They are the only team in the top four leagues of English football not to have won a game in 2022. They finally, sadly, parted ways with beloved manager Mark Robinson. He's an amazing person.
But they just can't keep you if you don't win, right?
Yeah. And it's really sad. I think it's really sad for him. It's really sad for the fans. Nobody's happy about it. It's just...
And the players liked him too, right?
Yeah. So it's just a sad situation. I mean, it's just... So we're now down into 22nd place. We are 4 points away from safety in 20th place. And even though AFC Wimbledon have managed these sort of like miracle turnarounds year after year after year since being promoted from League Two, mm-hmm. I have to say that this feels different.
I feel like the pain that is felt at AFC Wimbledon's losing streak needs its own Latin phrase.
It does. It does. Perhaps some listeners can suggest one.
Yeah.
It's just... really hard. There are 5 games left in the season, and it's hard to imagine how a team that has not won in 22 games is somehow going to win enough games of their final 5 to survive. I guess it's possible.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to imagine. And so this is, it's really sad, man. I mean, I just don't see how we can survive this year. I know we've had these miraculous last day stay ups for season after season, but this season it just looks different. And even more devastatingly, while we're talking about devastations, is the fact that the franchise currently plying its trade in Milton Keynes is second in League One and very likely to be promoted up to the second tier of English football. The only upside of that is that we won't have to play them next year, which will be nice because it is awful having to play them.
Cold comfort.
Yeah, so that's actually our next game is against the franchise currently playing its trade in Milton Keynes at Plough Lane. Their first time back in front of fans playing at Plough Lane against Milton Keynes. But they're in second.
We still have hope.
And we're in 22nd, so
we'll always have hope.
Yeah, I mean, we can never beat them because
it's too important.
We have a heart.
Yeah.
And so we have like a beating heart.
Just one?
Yes. But they have none. They have no hearts.
Maybe the phrase is something about a single beating heart. One heart. How would we say that?
I don't know.
One heart, zero wins.
I never got to Latin too. I assume that's where you learn that stuff.
Yeah.
That reminds me though of this bus in the, I think 2010 World Cup, where the Brazilian bus had written on the side of it in Portuguese, powered by the beating of 93 million Brazilian hearts.
Wow.
And I was like, that's too much pressure.
You can't perform.
You can't saddle Roberto Firmino with that kind of pressure. Yeah, so Wimbledon, it's not good. Mars,
I don't have anything to share, I'm afraid.
It's still doing
anything?
Great. It's still doing great. Mars is up to Mars stuff. Mars don't care. That's actually true.
Not nature.
It's true. Nature is not indifferent to our sorrows, but Mars truly is.
Yes.
Thank God that there's something out there that doesn't really care how we're doing.
Can we mess up Mars?
Probably.
Yeah. Well, let's hope. We don't.
It is currently rumbling with mysterious Mars quakes that we have not previously understood. And there are also more Mars quakes than we understood. And the sort of like best guess is that there is ongoing volcanic activity in Mars, which is interesting.
In Mars? On Mars?
Well, I get, most of it's under the surface.
In.
So in.
Okay.
But I don't, that's a great, prepositions are so inadequate to the problems that we face as a species. This is one of my high horses that I like to get on. But yeah, so we'll talk next week about Mars quakes.
Is Hank going to be back?
No.
No?
No, I have one more week without Hank.
Is it me?
We'll find out next week. Thanks for making a pod with me, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, John.
And thanks to everybody for listening. You can send us your questions at hankandjohn@gmail.com. This podcast is edited by the brilliant Joseph Tuna Medish. It's produced by Rosianne Hals Rojas. Our head of community and communications is Julia Bloom. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.